ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Okay, a cup of flour, 100 grams of icing sugar, okay, a tablespoon of cocoa powder. You know, I love a sweet treat, but making them is not within my comfort zone. I get into a bit of a tiz if you ask me to bake. Too much attention to detail. Now the butter, one egg. But according to some, baking, the everyday act of whipping up a cake or biscuit, that's a skill that comes close to cracking the meaning of life. Well, when I say some, I actually mean one. Psychologist and baker supreme Helen Goh. You might know her as co-author with Yotam Ottolenghi of Sweet, that sumptuous 2017 compendium of delectable desserts. Goh has been part of Team Ottolenghi for better than a decade. And before that, she trained as a psychologist. So when she comes out with a book called Baking and the Meaning of Life, a tome that makes the modest assurance that it can help you find joy in 100 recipes, well, you pause for thought. I mean, surely not. But then, a psychologist who bakes, it sounds like the therapy I need. I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science and history collide. This week, A Baker's Delights, Helen Goh and the Meaning of Life. Helen, what is the meaning of life?
Oh, that's a $1 million question. Well, I couldn't say it to you in one word, but I could give it to you in 100 recipes, Jonathan.
Which I think you have done.
I have, yes.
I'm intrigued there because the recipes are baked things.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between baking and cooking? Yes. Why do I get closer to the meaning of life with a cake and not with braising an eggplant?
That is such a good question. I think, essentially, it's because no one needs to eat cake. No one needs to eat, you know, biscuits and, confectionery. Why do we do it then, you know? So, of course, we've always celebrated with food. You know, food is kind of integral. But somehow we mark really important moments with cake. And so why do we do that? So it's actually the symbolism of it. The fact that no one needs to eat it alerts us to this idea that there's another reason why we do it. And for me, baking is kind of unique in being able to convey something, whether it's because you're making an apple pie for a sick friend. You know, that's one of the recipes in the book. And I tell the story of how the recipe came to be. And it's because a friend who had undergone, you know, chemotherapy and who was kind of finishing his treatments, and he was sort of craving an apple pie. And over the course of his illness, I had delivered, you know, lasagnas and salads and soups over. And of course, they were very appreciative as a family. But it was something about the cake that it symbolized something. It was about his recovery. There was something very special about having a baked thing delivered to him. It was what it represented, I think.
And the circumstances in which we make those baked things, they're either maybe a moment of personal indulgence, but more often they're marking something. They're
exactly
celebratory or generous.
Exactly. It's that idea of it symbolizing something. I mean, who of us have not had a birthday cake made for us? And even those of us who don't eat cake, you know, you can't help but be, I mean, of course, who doesn't eat cake? But this idea of something being presented to you, usually baking is effortful. So you know instantly when someone's made you something that they've gone to a bit of effort. So there's inherent in that is this idea of care and love. It's a shortcut to conveying something of that feeling of, I'm thinking of you, I thought of you, I'm making this for you.
I like that idea that baking is effortful because I think that's another distinction between the simple art of cooking and baking, which is so particular. It is precise and intricate often. And I wonder if they're two different people, the baker and the cook.
It's funny because lots of people often say to me, "Oh, I can cook, but I don't bake." Mm. And
I could say that to you.
Could you? Yes. Well, many people seem to say that. And I find it puzzling because if you can read, you can bake.
You can bake.
You know, because it's a series of instructions.
If you can weigh, you can bake.
Exactly. Right. Exactly right. Have you heard of people talking about how therapeutic baking is?
Mm.
Right. On the one hand, people say, "Oh gosh, that stresses me out. I can't do that." But then you hear of a lot of people saying, "Oh, if I'm stressed, I go and bake something." And I think that's because it's effortful. So you have to focus and concentrate. And that takes you out of that sort of white noise of your head, you know, ruminating about what you said to somebody that you regret, or thinking about what you're going to do tomorrow that you're anxious about. It's just effortful enough for you to need to be mindful of what you're doing. It's kind of sensorial. It's very embodied. You have to sort of participate in what you're making rather than, for example, stirring onions. You know, you could be speaking to somebody and stirring onions rather than concentrating on weighing this amount of sugar.
Yes.
Or butter. But the thing is, I think what's amazing about baking is that it's just effortful enough to take you out of that hubble bubble of life, but it's not so challenging that you feel stressed. And I think that sort of window is where it can be very therapeutic for some people.
Is this the psychologist in you making that deconstruction?
I think probably. I mean, in the past when I've had publishers contact me, once they find out that I bake and I'm a psychologist, you know, I've had interest in people saying, "Could you write a book about the therapeuticness of baking?"
Mm.
And I thought, well, yes. And then what else can you say? And I think for me, this book that I've just written is about much more than this idea of it as therapy. It's about life, actually, and the meaning of life. And what I mean by that is this idea that we connect through baking. I mean, I might tell you a story. There was a series of natural disasters around the world that was sort of quite unnerving. And the deadliest one was the earthquake in Syria and Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
That was in early 2023. And as we were all sort of watching this unfold, filled with sadness and helplessness, there was a British-Turkish cook called Melek Erdal. And she decided that we can't sit around being helpless. So she organized a bake sale. And we were all contacted via the Bush Telegraph, which is Instagram, of course. and we were all told to bake as many things as we could for this bake sale and to deliver it to a pub in North London on a Saturday morning at 7 o'clock. So we all just got baking, and I honestly don't think I slept for 2 days. I made cupcakes and cornbread and cheese scones. And the Saturday morning came, and I had, you know, boxes of these goods, baked goods, and my children got in the car with me and my husband drove, because we were all kind of balancing boxes of, you know, cupcakes. And so we drove to this pub in North London, and I dropped off everything, and it was very early, and there were bakers setting up these stalls. And as we entered, we were given boxes, empty boxes, because we were encouraged to buy in a kind of circular economy, you know, drop off something, buy something, all donating money to the British Red Cross. Anyway, so I got back into the car with our freshly bought goods, and my husband said to me, he'd been waiting in the car because it was sort of packed, and he said to me, "That's a wildly inefficient way to raise money." You know, and I thought, you know what, you're absolutely right, because it would have been more efficient if we'd all just donated £20. But there we were, you know, dozens of us, baking for days and nights, trying to sell cupcakes for £2. And then I thought, and I said to him, "But what you didn't experience in that room was this idea of, for example, the bakers feeling this sense of belonging, like we were this sort of group of bakers who had this autonomy and pride that we were doing something that was reaching out in solidarity to our fellow humans thousands of miles away in an act of kind of community and solidarity." And we spoke about this all the way home. And I think actually it was sort of the catalyst for the book, actually, because it wasn't just about the comfort of eating a piece of cake or cornbread. It was actually the symbolism. Yes, we could have raised more money by just donating money, but it was more than that. It was about a group of humans getting together in solidarity, in a sense of belonging, with the sense of pride and competence that we could do something.
And you talk in the book about an authentic and fulfilling life.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing, and I think these are where the worlds of baking and psychology meet, you talk about finding the ingredients for that kind of existence.
Yes.
It's like making a cake. Can you, you talk about coherence, purpose, significance?
Yes. Yes, and I think baking uniquely is that vehicle for us to feel this sense of purpose. You know, as I, in that story that I described, for 2 days we had this purpose just to bake as much as we could.
And the purpose needn't be direct. It needn't be something which necessarily reaches the people that you're trying to help financially.
Yes, exactly.
It helps that other body of humans, and every yes. little body of humans that is helped is a body of humans that is helped.
Exactly. You know, for a number of years when I worked the night shift, I had Saturday mornings off, and my sister, who's a midwife, who was a midwife at the Royal Women's Hospital, she was doing the night shift over the weekends, and she would finish work at 6 o'clock, and she would swing by this bakery in Fitzroy. And normally this bakery would have a queue of people lining up, but because it was 6 o'clock in the morning, she would sort of knock on the door and ask to buy 2 shoofly buns. And then she would pick up the paper and drop this off for me in my home. And I would wake up to this. And it was this sense of significance.
It's a beautiful gesture.
It is such a beautiful gesture. I mean, I think if she dropped off a salad, I might've appreciated it, but it just wouldn't have given me that sense of, I don't know.
It's the fundamental uselessness of the baked object
exactly
that makes it important.
Jonathan, that's exactly yes. it, because nobody needs to eat that. And so why else do you do it?
It is purely for pleasure.
It's what it symbolises, yes.
From ABC Radio National, this is Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green. And today, the doctor is in. We're meeting Helen Goh, master cook and baker, and longtime Ottolenghi associate, but also a doctor of psychology. Her debut solo cookbook taps into both sides of her training. It's called Baking and the Meaning of Life. Well, Helen's counsel is making a lot of sense to me, but I think it's time to put theory into practice in the kitchen.
Talk me through. What are the bits?
So we're making a biscuit called, what is it called? Hazelnut and chocolate. Oh, is it chocolate or hazelnut thins? What is it?
It could be either way.
It could be either way. Chocolate and hazelnut thins. What I really love about this recipe is that you make the dough, you press the dough into a tin, and then it keeps in the fridge ready for you to bake fresh cookies.
Anytime you want.
Anytime you want.
Or
you've
need.
Got it on tap. Yeah, need, exactly. Need or want. So the main flavours here are coffee, hazelnut, but we're going to do the dry ingredients first. So the flour's going into the food processor. So it's all made in one food processor, which is also super easy.
Yes.
It's got some almond meal in it, caster sugar, as well as brown sugar.
Multiple sugars is always nice.
Multiple sugars. Why have one when you can have two, right? And it has spent coffee grounds. So many people have their own coffee machines that they're, you know, making their own coffees. And usually you just throw away those damp coffee. But they're actually really, really good in baking. And the dampness means that it doesn't absorb all the moisture from your dough. So you get this sort of beautiful coffee flavour without it being drying. I mean, if you don't have spent coffee grounds, you can also just use normal coffee grounds. But I just also love the idea of recycling it.
Not kind of nice.
Yeah.
Better than just sticking it in the compost.
Exactly. So you've got the dry ingredients here, and you just want to pulse it to bring it together. So you're just really pulsing to bring it together. Okay. And pop the butter in. And then you want to pulse that to make it kind of crumbly. So see how it's all crumbly?
Yep.
Now we're going to add coffee and vanilla. How much vanilla is in it?
Is it an out-of-body experience consulting your own book?
I wouldn't say it's an out-of-body experience, but it's slightly embarrassing. It's like, you wrote the book. Do you not know
should
the recipe?
Know. Yes.
But to my defence, there's 100 recipes. I can't be expected to know all that, can I?
Many of which will have vanilla. It could get very confusing.
Yes, many have vanilla. And salt. You know, salt is really important for baking. It just mellows out that sugar and just balances out that flavour. So now, cinnamon. Enough that you want to taste it, but not so much that you're thinking, oh, cinnamon cookies, because it's not a cinnamon cookie.
Hmm.
The cinnamon is a supporting actor. So now you've got the liquid in it, we're going to bring yes. it together into a dough. I love the pulse button. It's just It's all about control. It's me being a control freak.
You sort of fell into baking from the deep end. This is not a family thing. You were born in Malaysia, you came here. You write in the book about your mother's interesting relationship with her first oven. Oh.
Well, you know, in Malaysia, you don't bake things. You steam cakes or you boil things, but you don't really bake. I mean, that was a long time ago, Jonathan, so things have changed a bit. But when we came to Australia and then we moved into our first house, my mother, this strange thing called the oven, you know, I think as long as we lived in that house, I don't remember that oven ever being used.
She used to store stuff in
it. Yes, she stored sort of funky, pungent stuff like dried fish and fermented vegetables and things like that.
That's putting it to good use.
Well, that's what she thought, yes.
But then baking is the thing which you were suddenly running a cafe without...
Oh, I know. How
having
did we get
kind of
there?
Worked in that world.
Oh, gosh, this is a long story, but I could try and skim through it. So I did study psychology at university, and that was an undergraduate course, and I wanted to do a postgraduate, and the faculty said to me, you're too young, go away and get some life experience.
Being psychology, after all.
Well, fair enough too, right? You do, you know, you don't want a callow 18-year-old trying to counsel you through a divorce or something. So I think it was a good call. But because I did a Bachelor of Science, I fell into a job of pharmaceutical, I think the correct word is medical detailer, a pharmaceutical rep for a German company. And part of my job was to learn about new products, new drugs, and then to talk to doctors to kind of sell them these drugs, I guess. And you'd kind of go door to door. And what I realized was that if I could organize a lunch and get all the doctors to come to the lunch, then I had a captive audience and I could just talk to them en masse about these drugs, which sort of saved me time going door to door. But over time, I realized that I was actually much more interested in the food that we were serving than in the actual drugs that I was supposed to be informing them about. And I think I just listened to that and thought, you know, actually, I'm spending 80% of my day creating a menu for the lunch and 20% trying to, you know, get myself clued up on these drugs. And eventually, I think I just went to the caterer who was catering for these events and said, can I have a job? So I did. I wasn't very good, so I got the sack after 2 days. And just by coincidence, my boyfriend at the time, who was a journalist, they were restructuring at the paper, and there was an opportunity to take a redundancy package. And he'd said to me, what would you do if you had this sum of money? And I said, oh my gosh, I would just open a cafe, of course. And he said, let's do it. I mean, we were just completely mad, I think, because neither of us had had any experience. He was a journalist and I was I don't know what I was then. So he said yes, and then we just did it.
And you made it work.
We did make it work, and it was actually hugely successful for a tiny little thing in Hawthorne. It was called Mortar and Pestle. And it was, I mean, probably the best and worst thing I've ever done, you know.
But you had wonderful mentors as well in your cooking life. Duray Dara,
yes.
For example, Stephanie Alexander's one-time restaurant partner.
That's right.
Kind of took you under her wing a little?
Well, because our cafe was in Auburn Road, up the road is Stephanie's, the restaurant Stephanie's, you know, which for many, many years, I mean, it's closed down now, but I mean, Stephanie remains a doyen of the industry. But Duray, I think, and a lot of the cooks and chefs used to come to our cafe as a pit stop to work, you know, either in their break or on their way to work. And over time, I got to know Duray, and she kind of monitored me. I think she was sort of seeing that I was trying very hard. She was seeing that there were days when I was so stressed I couldn't talk to anybody. Mm. She could see in my eyes that I hadn't slept. She was just kind of monitoring me, and she over time became a bit of a fixture of our cafe. And when we decided to sell, she said to me, now I want you to follow me. I don't know exactly what we're going to do, but you're going to stick with me and everything is going to be fine. And so she got me to, I guess the word is to consult, to create recipes and to develop recipes. And from there, we just kind of build a working relationship.
Another mentor would have to be Yata Motulenghi, and you're working with him for more than a decade.
Yes, almost, well, on and off for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, I've kind of on and off. I mean, I took some time off to do a doctorate for my psychology, and then I took some time off to have kids, but somehow I've always found my way back to that Motulenghi test kitchen.
And he's always been very encouraging that you tell a couple of stories here and there about particularities of Australian baking culture, which he's enthusiastically adopted. Mm-hmm. Things like the Anzac biscuit.
Oh, yes.
Yo-yos.
Yes.
I wonder, is there something about that Australian baking culture that is quite specific?
The sponges and pavs. Yeah, I reckon that is. I think there's an honesty to Australian baking. There's an honesty to kind of, you know, simple goodness. And that was probably what they saw in me when I first landed at the Motulenghi kitchen. I actually made the yo-yo biscuits because I felt homesick. I wanted something during my break to have with my cup of tea. And I made yo-yo biscuits, and it was a hit with not just everyone at Motulenghi, all the chefs, but also the customers. And also we had some homesick Aussies there too. And that spoke to them. It just suddenly, you know, they were gorgeous, so beautiful and colourful and delicious and simple. So then I got onto baking Anzac biscuits, and they loved that too. There's just that honesty, I think, in it.
That idea of improvisation, the Anzac biscuit, of course, but Motulenghi courted controversy with his Anzac biscuits.
Yes,
making unauthorised additions to the...
We're always doing that. And we did get some blowback with that. And in the end, we thought, well, we're kind of claiming it as our own.
It's an oat biscuit. Is that a thing with baking, though? I mean, when we think of baking, we tend to think of something which is a bit more pinned down. I mean, a lot of people will happily improvise in the kitchen with various techniques and different ingredients and so forth. But baking...
You know, I mean, as I said, a lot of people say this. I guess the thing is there are certain rules. And, you know, if you follow the instructions, yes, you're going to make a cake. But if you attend to some rules that are helpful in baking, you may get a better cake. So, for example, if you beat a batter very vigorously, you're going to work the gluten in the flour, and that's going to give you a cake that's more like bread. So it's chewy and it's tough. So it's still edible, but somehow it's not kind of delicate and bouncy like a sponge. So just knowing that means that, you know, don't beat your batter too vigorously. It's not bread. So there are certain things like that, that if you are cognizant of, then you're going to be a good baker. But everyone can bake. It's this sort of little extra that might make you a better baker, for example.
And how important is that little extra in this idea of also pursuing meaningful living?
That's a good question. I think the short answer to that is it's not at all important, because it's not really about the difference between a good cake and an excellent cake. It's this idea that you're bringing it to the table to have a cup of tea with somebody and enjoying a conversation, and the cake is really a vehicle to that. No one makes a cake for themselves. There's usually a relationship around it. So that's the key thing. So if it allows you to build on that relationship, to connect to that person that you want to share that cake with, then that's what matters.
Well, back to the kitchen, where I must admit, I'm feeling part of something bigger than myself.
So you see, it's just come together. It's not
just formed
completely
up nicely,
solid.
Yep.
Yeah. So the other part in it is hazelnuts, because you want texture.
This is going to make a good noise.
You're right. Is that good?
It's getting there,
yeah,
I think
that's good. So the crumbles, it's now forming a dough because we've put that little bit of coffee in and we've put the nuts in. And just as soon as it forms a dough, you're just going to pat that into the loaf tin.
So you're not working it too vigorously?
No, you're not. I mean, what I'm doing here is just to really make sure that the nuts are distributed through the dough. I don't even really need to do very much to it. It's just so that I don't get one end with all the nuts and and then...
Because that just wouldn't be fair.
It just wouldn't be fair. And then that poor person who gets that nutless bit. And once you've pressed it in, fold the baking paper over that just to protect it from all the smells in the fridge, because this now needs to go into the fridge for 2 hours minimum until you're ready. Ready to slice.
And then how long to bake from there?
12 minutes. Just 12 minutes. You're only 12 minutes away from fresh cookies. Well, actually, I also like to, maybe this is gilding the lily a bit, but I also like to dip just a small edge of it in chocolate. It just takes it from kind of a nice cookie to something a little more luxurious.
That's a nice touch.
It is a nice touch. But you don't have to do that, but we like a bit of extra.
So. What do we call this little person?
This little person is called chocolate and hazelnut thins. No, it is called hazelnut coffee thins. I should know the recipes in my own book, shouldn't I? There are 100, Jonathan.
We got there at the end.
What is it? Hazelnut coffee thins. There you go. Mm.
I wonder if we're baking for meaning and baking for a sense of growth in the self, how do we then deal with our failures?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I really love baking with my younger son, although we really have to fish eggshells out of batter and we have crunchy batter because of all the eggshells in it. But one of the reasons I love baking with him is the sense that you can fail. Baking is a low stakes environment for you to fail. It doesn't matter if the cake is a bit wonky. And what I love is seeing him fail and try again. So you might make brownies and then next week the brownies will be better. He'll do something more efficiently. You know, it's low stakes. It doesn't matter. It's only a brownie. So for me, it's a kind of subset of the larger thing about life, trying, curiosity, failing, trying again, and mastery and achievement. This idea that you can, over time, master something. So in this micro environment of our kitchen in Shepherd's Bush in West London, it's this micro environment of him testing out real life, failing, trying again, being curious and mastering something. And I feel proud that we have this relationship and environment for him to test out something about life.
Well, after 2 hours in the fridge and 12 minutes in the oven, I have biscuit in hand. And this particular morsel seems like, well, anything but a failure. Oh, yum. What else could you call this feeling but joy? She's right, isn't she? It's the essentially generous nature of baked goods, their association with giving, of a special moment of sweet luxury. That's what elevates baking beyond the quotidian necessities of ordinary cooking. The meaning of life, the gift of a cake. Maybe those two have more than a little in common. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. And thanks to our guest, Helen Goh, her new book is called Baking and the Meaning of Life, How to Find Joy in 100 Recipes. And you can hear Every Bite on ABC Radio National or anytime on the ABC Listen app. Check us out there and share an episode around. Why? Because it will add joy. It will. We love hearing what you think of the show. We read all your emails, and maybe you have an idea for a future episode. Shoot us a line to everybite, or one word, at abc.net.au. everybite@abc.net.au. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jirik. I'm Jonathan Green.